All right, this is the second of the four cases that we have submitted today. We only have two cases being submitted with oral argument, and y'all, of course, were the first case, and we've rearranged the order. All right, let's call the second case.
The court will now call Texas Department of Criminal Justice versus Bonnie Ledbetter et al. May it please the court, Ms. Kim Coogan to argue for the appellate, and Ms. Kate Smith to argue for the appellate.
Good morning. May it please the court. The state wins this case because the plaintiffs have not pled sufficient jurisdictional facts to allege a waiver of sovereign immunity under the Texas Tort Claims Act. More specifically, they have not pled how the use of restraints was negligent and proximately caused the death of Mr. Ledbetter.
Let me ask you kind of to start things off. What are the circumstances under which we look strictly to the, we'll invoke insurance law, four corners of the pleading, as opposed to looking behind the pleading at other facts that may or may not support what the pleading says?
Well, I think what Miranda versus Texas Parks and Wildlife says is where the four corners of the pleadings sufficiently allege jurisdictional facts, and the trial court doesn't need to look beyond them, then the trial court can limit itself to the four corners of the petition. In this case, though, like in Miranda, the plaintiffs pled multiple theories of negligence. They pled everything from use of hand restraints to that Mr. Ledbetter had a seizure, that medical devices were improperly used, that there had been an improper use of a motor vehicle under the Texas Tort Claims Act. And so after special exceptions and after five petitions filed by the plaintiffs, the Texas Department of Criminal Justice finally said, we still don't understand how you allege that the use of restraints proximately caused this gentleman's death. And we attached to the plea to the jurisdiction the autopsy report, in which the Tarrant County medical examiner said, heart attack.
But that would be going outside the pleading.
That's correct. And the Supreme Court in Miranda said that where the trial court needs to look outside the pleadings purely to establish jurisdictional facts one way or the other, that the trial court is able to do that, and that the trial court has a right to do that so that the court can determine whether it has jurisdiction or not. In a case that does not involve the state, it may not ever be necessary to look outside the pleadings. But because the pleadings are jurisdictional in a case against the state, it is important for the court to establish at its earliest possible date whether it has jurisdiction or not. Now, Miranda did say sometimes the merits and the jurisdictional facts are intertwined and the court's not able to make a decision early on about jurisdictional facts. But in this case, there just simply weren't any pleadings that even on a notice pleading kind of standard, much less a jurisdictional standard, told TDCJ, this is how your prison guard negligently used these restraints that caused the death of Mr. Ledbetter.
Why isn't that a matter for special exceptions, that they just didn't specify how, because they did plead causation?
We did specially accept. And the plaintiffs repled four times. And after four times, and after special exceptions, we finally said, okay, now it's our turn to have a plea to the jurisdiction and really ask the court to make a determination about whether your Fifth Amendment amended petition now asserts any jurisdictional facts that get you jurisdictionally inside by alleging a cause of action under the Tort Claims Act. Tell us how the negligent use of restraints proximately caused his death. There were 20 theories about that, but there weren't any facts that substantiated any of them. And what's significant about this is that after special exceptions were first filed, all of the paper discovery was done. TDCJ turned over something like 500, more than 500 pages of an investigation that was done by TDCJ after this death.
Has the deposition of the nurse who suctioned out the airways of the deceased been taken?
It's never been requested, and it has never been taken. Her statement was given, and in her statement she said that the airway was clear when she went to suction it out.
Wouldn't that have meant clear for the purposes of suctioning out? I mean, she couldn't see beyond what she could see of the throat, right?
Perhaps. Now, if there were vomitus in the throat, that would have been suctioned out. So, respectfully, I would disagree with you on that. But it really doesn't matter whether I agree with Justice or not. The autopsy report says it was congestive heart failure due to hypertensive and cardiovascular disease.
Yeah, so the autopsy report does not address the possibility of the contributing factor, if there is any, by aspirating vomit. It just doesn't address it.
Well, respectfully, Your Honor, I disagree. I think the absence of vomitus in the lungs on autopsy is an indication that there was none. In other words, I believe that if vomitus, based on my experience in other cases, if there were vomitus in the lungs that caused Mr. Ledbetter to aspirate, that's exactly the kind of thing that would be in the autopsy. And its absence is evidence that was not a cause of his death.
Conclusively?
In the absence of any evidence to the contrary. I mean, in the absence of anything to the contrary, and this case has been on file for 2 years now, and so there has been ample opportunity, if there is some evidence of anything other than a heart attack, I would like to believe that in response to our special exceptions and our plea, we would have seen it by now. But let's give all deference to the plaintiff's pleadings. How did the use of hand restraints cause him to vomit or aspirate, assuming that that's what happened, even though there's no evidence of that? There's no evidence that he had a stroke, that he had an aneurysm, that he had a seizure, that he had a broken leg. There's no evidence of any of the multiple potential ways a person can die, and there's no evidence of any of the multiple theories of negligence that have been pled.
Where were the restraints? Can you go over that with me?
The restraints were on his hands and legs, and then connecting those hands and legs.
Okay, how is that? With a chain running from the legs to the hands?
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that's important because if the evidence were that the restraints had ended up around his neck, or if there was evidence that the restraints were defective, you know, they had been too long or too short, or they had somehow not worked properly, or if they had gotten off or been too tight, if there was some evidence that there was some defect with the restraints, then we might be able to have a fact question about whether the restraints could have caused his death. But there isn't any allegation of a defect with the restraints. There's not even, there's potentially a pleading that it was negligent to use them, although I think I'm not sure how reasonable a claim that would be when you transfer a prisoner from one prison property to another prison property to allege that he shouldn't be wearing restraints. But there's no allegation or evidence that there was something about the restraints that caused him either to have a heart attack or caused him to vomit. And what we or caused him to aspirate. assuming that's what happened, even though there's no evidence of it. We know that before he ever got into the prison van, he was beginning to have the signs of a heart attack. He was vomiting back at the prison. He was somewhat incoherent. And that is what caused the guards to seek medical attention for him. There wasn't a 24-hour clinic. This was something like 4 o'clock in the morning. There wasn't a 24-hour clinic at the Middleton unit, but on the same prison property, there is a Robertson unit that has a 24-hour clinic. And the witness statements indicated it took about 2 minutes to get him from the back door of one unit to the back door of the other unit. And so they took him out to the prison van, they put him in the van, they drove him to the other unit that had a clinic, and by the time they got that 2 minutes later across the prison property, he was either dead or very near death. And so ultimately we still have the question, regardless of whether there is a fact question about whether he had a heart attack, as the coroner said, or aspirated on his own vomit, as is theorized, what is the question, if you send it back to the trial court, that you're going to ask a jury to decide? Did use of hand restraints cause him to vomit? Bosley, the Supreme Court in Bosley, tells us that is simply too attenuated of a stretch. Unless you have some defect with the handcuffs, unless they're wrapped around his neck or there's some relationship of the handcuffs, the restraints.
You mean caused him to aspirate vomit?
Whatever the theory of death is, there, many are pled. The only one that's before the court is the use of the restraints. But how does being restrained cause you to aspirate or to die to vomit, number one, or to aspirate from
it? Well, I think her contention is, or his contention is, caused him to be unable to prevent aspirating by moving his head or something to that effect.
How?
Okay, so I guess what I was thinking was, she was saying that he was restrained on his back, and so when he vomited, then he could not turn himself. Mm-hmm. But what you're saying is that...
That's what I was getting to.
But what you're saying is, if we look on page 7 of your brief under the allegations regarding the restraint, if you look at number 3, which is kind of the one, I'll read it to you, it's very short, the one that's most on point, it says, affirmatively using personal property, the restraining devices to restrain John Ledbetter while he was vomiting without a way to allow him to protect himself. So what you're saying is that, as worded, is not enough to put you on notice of how, of if she was saying he was restrained on his back, you knew he was vomiting, then he vomited again with you in sitting in the front seat, and he didn't have a way to roll over or to do something to get rid of the vomit in his throat. That's not enough to tell you that, and so that's why we go outside of the pleading to look at the facts. Is that what you're saying?
It is, Justice.
Now, what if we do go outside of the facts as pled and look at every evidence? Now, what are we looking for? Does she just need to raise a fact question? I know it's evidence in the record that he was placed there on his side. When he got there, he was on his stomach. Okay, indicating that restraining on the back did not occur. Okay, but are we just looking for a fact question, and a fact question raised is enough? What is your position on that?
My position is that the plaintiff has the burden of proof to plead and ultimately prove some jurisdictional facts that are true that tell my client what they're being sued for and why.
Well, if they have the burden to prove, you mean at the motion, that the plea of jurisdiction stage?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
Ultimately, with the trier of facts, the trial stage.
Because I understand the burden to be on the state here.
True.
On this pleading to essentially prove the same thing as a motion for summary judgment, a traditional motion for summary judgment.
It's close, but I don't think it is the same thing, because what we're saying is it's not unusual to get a plaintiff's complaint that you think is full of facts that are unsubstantiated. But the plaintiff, this is a jurisdictional issue now. And what we're saying with our special exceptions initially is time out. And ultimately with our plea to the jurisdiction, all of the written discovery has been produced. And if you want some depositions, you're welcome to take them. But the evidence is that he never was laid down on his back, and that even if he had been laid down on his back, there's no evidence that he vomited or aspirated on it, and he had a heart attack. So if you have something, if you have some facts to tell me in good faith that something other than these undisputed facts happened, then I, as a defendant, have a right to see what those facts are, certainly after 2 years. And the trial court, what Miranda's saying is, you can plead anything you want to. You can plead yourself into a waiver of sovereign immunity. All you have to do is say the magic words, and you have pled it. And I don't have to establish that they pled in bad faith. But when I have evidence to the contrary that's undisputed, what is the benefit of putting the state to trial when the legislature and the Supreme Court have already said this is a jurisdictional problem? There just isn't a waiver of sovereign immunity under these facts as you've pled them. There's not even a fact question for a jury.
So the evidence that you brought forward is the autopsy report that is silent as to any contribution by aspirating or use of the restraints to cause, that it contributed to cause death. Silence. I'm correct me if I'm wrong. I'm just trying to add it up. And the statement of the nurse, the handwritten statement, in which she says she checked his airways and she suctioned him out.
And a statement by the guard who placed him in the van, that he placed him on his side specifically so that if he did vomit, he would not aspirate. That was specifically included in the guard's statement. I will say with regard to the medical examiner, he doesn't know that the plaintiffs are going to file a lawsuit or that they think that he was handcuffed incorrectly. He doesn't have any idea about any of the underlying facts of this guy's incarceration.
I understand.
He's just trying to figure out what caused his death. And he says it's congestive heart failure. There are cases where people vomit and aspirate. And that vomitus is not only in the airways, but it's in the lungs. And there just wasn't any in this case. I can't imagine what a fact question for the jury would look like if there's no evidence of vomitus in his lungs.
Well, they don't have to come forward with any evidence until your evidence conclusively establishes lack of causation, right? And at this stage, on a motion to dismiss for want of jurisdiction.
I believe they have to come forward with some facts. Facts, not some theories, but some facts.
To establish a
to dispute
fact
it.
Issue.
To dispute it, yes, Your Honor. To create a fact issue.
I just am having a problem in seeing how the state's evidence, not the state, the department's
sure.
evidence, meets that standard that's set forth in Miranda, that it mirrors a traditional motion for summary judgment. I don't see how the evidence does that of the... I understand that the autopsy frequently doesn't address every possible contributing cause, and then the other two things, the nurse's statement and so forth, I'm not sure that establishes it as a matter of law, lack of causation.
Question. I know we're not following our time limits today, but I have one question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I have one question.
Yes, Your Honor.
Counsel, I'd refer to page 15 of the appellee's brief, and at that part of the brief, it says, additionally, the autopsy notes that the lung mucosa is covered by abundant, somewhat frothy, pale gray mucus. This is consistent with aspiration of vomitus. The airways were patent, but the nursing staff at the Robertson unit suctioned John's airways, and that is to be expected.
The lawyer says that.
No, I'm asking you, I know the lawyer says that, but what I'm asking you, if you dispute, is that the quote from the autopsy report is correct in that it states that the lung mucosa is covered by abundant, somewhat frothy, male gray mucus. Is that in the autopsy report?
It is, Your Honor.
So in your autopsy report where you're submitting for additional facts, because your contention is that the pleaded facts do not qualify the jurisdictional finding that was made in the trial court, and that your additional evidence still allows an interpretation to be made that there was some indication of vomitus.
No, Your Honor, does not indicate some indication of vomitus. Because if you ask an expert what that mucosa means, it means heart attack. Now, that's not in the record because the plaintiff has not raised that issue. And I suspect she doesn't have an expert statement, which would have defeated me.
Well, isn't that for trial? That's for trial. That's a fact question issue of what this indicates, what this language indicates from a medical finding and an interpretive viewpoint of an expert witness. That's not involved in our question here of is there adequate factual information from the pleadings of the plaintiff before you get to your submitted additional evidence in the pleadings of the plaintiff that there could have been a death caused by the use of personal property.
How? 2 points to that. First of all, the case has been on file for more than 2 years. So if the mucosa is any indication of vomitus, there has been every opportunity for the plaintiffs to make that out, to establish those facts, not establish them forever, but to come forward with something besides their own personal opinion. I could say mucosa means cancer, but what I say doesn't matter. That's a finding by the coroner, but not a finding of a cause of death.
All right, thank you.
All right, 6 minutes, 7 minutes. All right, let's give the appellee an additional 7 minutes.
I'm sorry about that.
Good morning. May it please the court. I apologize, first of all, for being late this morning. In regard to the issues here, the plea to the jurisdiction, basically what the state wants to do is to disprove the whole case under her plea to the jurisdiction. The situation here was a person who was almost unconscious or unconscious when he was placed in hand restraints. The hand restraints and the leg restraints were the hands, I've seen pictures, the hands, may I step out, and a chain from the hands through a belly leather strap down to the ankles. This is a very serious restraint for anybody, and especially somebody who's unconscious. As the court has seen, even though the guards testified or wrote in his statement that he placed the John on his side, he was found on the floor when they arrived at the unit. This is a 10-minute drive. I looked at the mileage between the two units, and it looks like about a 10-minute drive to the other unit.
Let me ask you this. I think the reason that everybody got the idea that he was placed on his back was because you say on page 14 of your brief, the use of the restraints was a direct cause of John's death because he could not turn himself to keep his airway open.
And
just that standing alone raises two questions. The only thing I saw was that he was placed on his side. And secondly, if he was unconscious, he couldn't turn himself to keep his airway open anyway.
That's correct, Your Honor, Justice. He ultimately wound up different ways, apparently, because he wound up on his face down.
Right.
Which means at some point, depending on the driving, and I don't know what the driving facts were, he could have rocked back on his back, too.
I think there wasn't there some mention in one of the reports that he was moving his head and arms as he was loaded, so that's why, one reason why they used the restraints.
According to the inmate who was in the seg cell, I've read his statement, who was next to him, he was trembling, his bones were shaking, and then he wasn't doing anything when they loaded him onto the gurney to take him out. That's what I read in the other inmate's statement.
Okay, well, let's just assume that the guards were negligent by not riding with him or by placing him on his back or something, but let's get to how that involves the use of personal property.
Well,
so I think I perceive that number three, as listed in her brief, is your lead dog. That is, affirmatively using personal property, the restraining devices, to restrain John Ledbetter while he was vomiting without a way to allow him to protect himself.
Well, Your Honor, there's no doubt that he had been vomiting all over the place. I mean, they said that he vomited all over the
right.
cell he was in. They had to change his clothing. So he was vomiting when he was in the
right. I think
unit,
we're focusing on the proximate cause between the restraining devices and his death. So how do we get there based just reading this or something else?
Anytime anyone's having a seizure, first thing you do is you go either put a belt in their mouth, tongue
blade.
Okay,
we're outside the record, I think, now.
Okay. And as far as the facts go, you've got to have somebody watching somebody who
okay, but has, again, I'm hearing
okay.
you. I'm hearing you. That
okay.
may be negligent, the way they laid him or the way that they were all in the front and he was in the back. I'm hearing you.
Uh-huh.
But we need to use something more than their negligence.
Use or misuse of tangible personal
right.
property.
In placing those restraints on him to such an extent and setting him back in the back, that's improper use of property if you've not got someone looking at him.
How did that cause his death?
By not being able to turn himself properly, clear his airway.
But the only evidence is that he was on his side, he ended up on his stomach, and if he was unconscious, he couldn't turn himself anyway, voluntarily.
But I disagree that was evidence. Those statements were not in the record, no more than that statement from other people that he was placed, that he was not conscious whenever he went to, they placed him on the gurney and placed him in the 15-passenger van. All those things were out of statements different people made. And basically he was placed in there without any kind of supervision. I mean, a hospital, as soon as someone vomits and or begins having seizure activity, those hospitals are going to have somebody down there watching them all the time until they're clear. This is not what happened in this case. He was placed in a van, whether really on his side or not, we don't know. I think that's a fact issue because I tend to think that maybe not. But he was placed in a van, restrained like worse than a dog would be restrained, basically, and left there while other people got, the people who were supposed to be taking care of him or protecting him, got in the front of the van, and nobody either turned over their head over their shoulder and watched him or anything. They just basically left him there for this approximate 10-minute drive to the other unit, which was not inside the same compound that the Middleton unit was in. It was another compound. And he was left to basically lay there and die.
Well, let me go ahead, Judge.
I was just going to, assuming that there is evidence that he was placed on his side initially, there seems to also be evidence from a someone's statement that he was lying on his side on the floor when they got to the Robertson unit, which I think, from which it could be inferred that he did move himself at some, or tried to move himself at some point during the 10-minute ride or 2-minute ride. I'm just, that could go, I suppose, either way.
If someone's struggling to breathe, and because they've, even an unconscious person can move somewhat, but we don't know whether he actually moved himself or the driving facts caused him to be in between the cage and the seat. We don't know how he got there. That's another fact issue for a jury to determine after we get depositions and witnesses at trial to find out exactly how he got into that position. There's several different statements about whether he was breathing or not when they got him to the Robinson unit. Some people say he was. Some of the guards, the nurses say definitely he wasn't. And they started CPR immediately. They knew he was not breathing. And so one of the guards at the gate said he couldn't tell whether he was breathing or not. So there's all kinds of fact issues that we've got to ferret out. Of course, this is a governmental tort claim, basically, and we've got to get past the waiver of immunity to go forward with the case. In order to do that, we've got to defeat the pleaded jurisdiction the state brought.
Let me ask you the same question that I asked her to begin with. What are the circumstances that you perceive that we go outside the pleading and look at facts behind the pleading?
Well, Your Honor, that the situation right now is there's a lot of facts out there and there's a lot of different stories out there. The evidence, even from their own guards or officers there, vary. It's not all the same. People, each person has told a different story. So if we look at all that evidence and try to figure it out, we have to do a lot more in-depth investigation. And according to the courts, this is not a time for us to prove our case. This is a time for, you know, to determine whether or not there is an issue. And I think there is a lot of fact issues here, whether or not John aspirated, whether or not he had congestive heart failure. This is a 36 or 38-year-old man. He had no history of congestive heart failure. So if you want to look outside the what's in the record, he had a plate in his head, which is not addressed in the autopsy, if you want to look outside the record. He certainly had some mental problems, partially because of the plate in his head, and he did not have anything that would indicate that he should he didn't have shortness of breath. They didn't talk about shortness of breath. Anybody who knows anything about congestive heart failure knows that they have tremendous shortness of breath before congestive heart failure kills them. There was nothing in the nurse's records, nothing in the guard's statements, nothing anywhere that said he had shortness of breath. If he was in congestive heart failure, I'm going to tell you, he would have had shortness of breath. I'm a nurse.
But aren't these facts issues that an expert witness should develop?
That's correct, Your Honor. And what we're asking is that we get the time to get past this plea to the jurisdiction and get to the fact issues. And one of the things that we haven't done is we've talked to a couple of experts, but we, you know, until we get past this point, the issue of expenses, particularly for our clients, is tremendous to do a second autopsy review and those kind of things, and that's what we've asked for, and that's what the court granted us, the trial court, and then the state took exception to that and filed an appeal.
Judge, I have a question, if I might. Was she through?
Skinkle, I'd like to delve into the items that are attached as to your appendix in your brief that includes a copy as Appendix C of your the plaintiff's fifth amended original petition. Within that portion of the brief, there is at the very last page before you go to Exhibit B, in other words, at the end of Exhibit A, which I take it is an attachment to the petition, a picture that shows apparently a body or a person with handcuffs, a chain linked to leg ankle cuffs, and I'd like to be careful that picture is what you contend are the personal property that was used by the state.
That's correct, Your Honor.
That picture is an accurate picture of the way he was, in the words in your brief, shackled.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then in terms of your allegations in your pleadings, on page 3, you're talking about facts about what occurred before Mr. Ledbetter was moved, and you talk about things that occurred in terms of his vomiting on the ground, the walls, on his clothing, and that he was not coherent, and that then he was placed in handcuffs, belly belt, and ankle cuffs with shackles to the ankles cuffs, where he could not move himself, needed to take care of himself when vomiting and transporting him by medical personnel. Then on page 4, the facts alleged are that despite the fact that the staff was well aware that John had been vomiting and had been placed in restraints not to be able to help himself, all three of them rode in the front seat of the van. Are those the facts that I'm thinking you're relying on in terms of factual allegations to meet the requirements for the waiver of immunity by the use of personal property?
Your Honor, as far as the way he was placed, the fact that he wasn't put in an ambulance instead of taken that in handcuffs where he couldn't, if it's hard if you don't have your arms free to get up, to move, to get your head where you need to be. Now, those things are facts, and that's improper use of those restraints whenever they should have taken him by ambulance to a medical facility. Instead, they chose to shackle him and take him to the other unit that had some nurses there that could do a little bit more than what the ones at the Middleton unit could do.
So is it your position that the use of outside evidence was not needed in the trial court because of the factual allegations in the pleading that I just read from?
Your Honor, the trial court made a determination that there was improper use or incorrect tangible property used in transporting John. The trial court did not include the failure to get an ambulance in its determination. Am I answering the question you're asking?
Yes, I think so. Thank you very much. As I read the order from the trial court, it's merely the handwritten portion of the order that's at the bottom of the page that we're really dealing with in terms of the case will proceed under the Texas Tort Claims Act solely predicated upon the alleged use or misuse of restraints.
That's correct, Your Honor. We also pled the failure to use the ambulance, some other failures, but
he didn't deal with that in his wording. He just dealt with what I just read.
That's correct, Your Honor.
All right, thank you.
I'm not sure the failure to use personal property gets you there, as opposed to the use or misuse.
And that the use or misuse is what we pled to. Is that the question?
All right, thank you.
But we're, okay, we're limited to looking at how the restraints were used by the trial court. Is this all? You haven't appealed, cross-appealed to you haven't cross-appealed regarding the limitation by the trial court to that one aspect?
No, we didn't, Your Honor. In essence, the trial court should be allowed to determine whether to develop, we could more fully develop our case on the merits. And basically, as we've written in our brief, that is left largely the trial court's discretion to exercise. The allegations of plaintiff in a plea to jurisdiction must be construed as true and construed in favor of the petitioner or the pleader. The facts are that he was vomiting, he was restrained, and was not able to move or lift his head to clear his airways. He also was either unconscious, maybe semi-conscious at the most, and without and was having some sort of seizures, because you just, your bones don't just shake without something going on. And that's the description, as I said, of the inmate that was next to him, which would have been a more honest, probably, description than the after-the-fact witness statements of the officers. Again, the autopsy report, I don't know if, how many of you all have seen autopsy reports, but they're usually about 30 to 36 pages in length. This autopsy report was 7 pages, and the last page was a lot of basically signature and that kind of information. Nothing, absolutely nothing about the fact that John had a skull injury previously and had a plate in his skull. If you've done an autopsy, you would know that, a complete autopsy. State argues that the medical examiner was not hired by them, but he knows where he's hired by. It's by the state. He might not be directly under the state's control, but he's very much under the state's control. The fact that they placed, this is a 15-passenger van. This could have been prevented by somebody sitting behind him, if nothing else. Maybe they didn't want to sit on the same seat, which that would be fine, but why didn't they sit behind him or have one of them assigned to watching him? They didn't do that. Yet they sat there with these cuffs on this man and had him restrained in a terrible, terrible manner, and continued to talk and go about their business without caring that he was sitting back, laying back there basically unprotected. And when they got there, and when they all were asked to make statements, they're all different. They're none of them the same. Some of them say he was breathing. Some of them say, I don't know. Some of them say, I heard him moaning right before we got there. They're different statements by each one of them. Others say, no, you know, they didn't hear him moaning. This needs to be developed. This case needs to go forward so that, and the state does, is liable in cases where an ordinary citizen would be liable if they fail to do something. And our contention is they failed to properly use those restraints, or they misused those restraints in applying them to John. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any other questions?
Even the state can admit that this is a very sad case. Hand and body restraints are used in maximum security prisons. They have to be. And in this particular case, this gentleman was ill. The guards noted that he was ill, and they immediately rushed him over on the same property to the medical facility. The statements in the record are that it took 2 minutes to get there. Anytime an inmate is taken outside the doors and outside of what they call the crash gates, the outside gates of one prison, even if it's just to move them across the property to the medical facility, they have to be secured. Not because TDCJ guards are mean, but because we have escapes all the time, including one last year in Bay City, where inmates who are shackled and secured, who claim to be ill, who claim to be paralyzed in wheelchairs, who claim to hang themselves, who claim to be unconscious, turn out to not be those things and become very, very dangerous and high risks for escapes. It's hard for some of us in the free world to imagine that someone would do something like throw up or hang themselves or feign quadriplegia to escape, but it happens every day, and it happens at TDCJ. The mere use of restraints, as unpleasant as it sounds and unpleasant, frankly, as it is nothing more than a safety mechanism, and it has to be done.
Let me ask this. When I started reading the facts, I thought we were going to read about furnishing a condition, and then I didn't see anything about that in the brief. Was I off base when I started reading and started thinking I was going to see this?
As a condition of which? Of the restraints or the van or?
You know, there's theory, you hang yourself from the bunk and it's the use of personal property. No, it's not. The bunk just furnished a condition.
Right.
I thought that's what we were going to hear on the restraints, but then I didn't hear anything about that, so maybe I was off.
Well, when I look at the definition of use, when it means to put into use, I just could not dispute the fact that TDCJ guards probably did put these handcuffs into use. It's not like the case where there's a telephone in a waiting room and an inmate puts it around his neck and strangles himself. The telephone just happens to be there. I do have to concede we put these into use.
Okay.
I won't concede that it was negligently, and I won't concede that it was the handcuffs that caused his death.
So the bottom line of what your position is that the item, the allegations that you have on 7, particularly 3, which seems to be the lead dog allegation, is insufficient to put you on notice of facts leading to use or misuse. And so for that reason, we can go outside the pleading and look at other things. Now, once we do that, if you are correct, what is your position as to what she needs to raise? Just a scintilla, a fact question to defeat a summary judgment? Is that what she needs? What is your position on that?
I think she has to come forward with some fact, not a theory, but a fact, to dispute my facts, which is that he died of congestive heart failure, or she has to come forward with some fact that the restraints caused the death.
She has to. Your position is she has to raise a fact question on use or misuse proximately causing death.
Yes, Your Honor.
All right.
Any other questions?
Any other questions, Judge Gardner, Judge Meyer?
No,
thank you.
Thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. Your case is submitted, and we appreciate y'all coming down to Fort Worth. We are adjourned.